hello, and welcome to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. On today's program, I'll be reading a number of stories, including one from the Parkville Qualcomm Beach News, in which a man shares the challenges of being blind on Vancouver Island. You'll hear a story from The Independent describing the scene at a House of Representatives hearing at which disability advocates in wheelchairs were dragged out. And you'll hear a piece from the American Bar Association regarding disability identity and law school admissions, along with other items of interest. Our first article this time comes from Harvard Magazine. It's entitled, Behind the Scenes, Quality of Care. Associate Editor Lydia Lyle Gibson reflects on why disability is a topic that needs to be talked about more openly. Americans don't talk much about disability. It's a subject that rarely cracks the national conversation, and even in one-on-one interactions, people often avoid it. There's fear and shame and stigma. Sometimes people just don't know what to say. But in a way, this is a strange silence. Nearly one-third of adults in this country, 73.4 million people, according to federal estimates, have some form of disability. And even more Americans have someone in their lives who is disabled. I have a close friend who went blind in her mid-20s. Watching her navigate a world that wasn't built for her and that often doesn't make accommodations has been enormously instructive. And just about everyone, if they live long enough, will likely develop a disabling impairment. In fact, long COVID has demonstrated just how susceptible anyone can be. So, disability is a topic that should be important to all of us. Why isn't it? When I first heard about Harvard Medical School researcher Lisa Iazzoni, I knew I had to talk to her. Iazzoni studies disability in settings where the failure to address it seems especially surprising. Hospitals, doctor's offices, and other clinical contexts. For nearly 30 years, she has been gathering data and conducting interviews with disabled patients who share their experiences seeking health care, their fears and frustrations, and their stories of neglect and discrimination. In many cases, she has been among the first to record and analyze these experiences. Her interest comes in part from her own life. Iazzoni, who has multiple sclerosis, has used a wheelchair for decades. A few years ago, she conducted a series of focus groups with doctors, which led to a nationwide survey. In interviews, doctors admitted to resentments and prejudices against patients with disabilities. Many told Iazzoni they didn't have the equipment to accommodate those patients, as required by the Americans with Disabilities Act. Without wheelchair-accessible scales, for example, some doctors said they sent patients to be weighed at supermarkets or grain elevators or zoos. But one statistic in that survey seems especially telling when it comes to our society's collective reluctance to talk about disability. 82% of doctors said that their disabled patients have a worse quality of life. It was striking for Iazzoni to see that number in black and white, even though she knew it was an opinion widely shared in the medical profession and beyond. Even reporters who had called to interview her about the survey had sometimes unthinkingly expressed the same assumptions. No wonder people tend to close themselves off from discussing disability. But it's an assumption that's incorrect. Research shows that a majority of people with disabilities, even serious and persistent ones, rate their quality of life as good or excellent. Most people with disabilities don't view their lives as tragic, Iazzoni told me, a claim that her own remarkable life bears out. The same is true of my friend who is blind. She's surrounded by friends, loved ones, and a devoted husband, engaged in meaningful work as a writer and teacher, immersed in the daily ebb and flow of the Chicago neighborhood where she lives. In fact, she's someone I've often turned to in gloomy moments when I need a dose of encouragement. Spending time with Iazzoni this winter, reading her books and journal papers, and talking with her colleagues and research collaborators, I learned so much about the place that disability occupies in our society and what that means, not only for disabled patients seeking care, but for all of us. Truly, we should talk more openly about disability. We could make life easier and better for everyone. Over the course of profiling Iazzoni and her work, I consulted with lots of people, including Harvard Magazine's longtime editor, John Rosenberg, who retired at the end of April and was helpful in thinking about how to shape this story. I'm grateful for the time and generosity Iazzoni and other researchers granted me as I worked to learn the landscape of this huge and too often invisible subject. And I'm grateful to have had the time and space to do this reporting, thanks to donors like you. And now here's a piece from the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network entitled, Disability Rights and Privacy Advocates Raise Concerns with Proposed Autism Registry. Letter to RFK Jr. details risks of surveillance, stigmatization, and marginalization. This was published May 13, 2025. Washington. The American Civil Liberties Union, the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, ASAN, and 80 other disability rights, civil rights, and public health organizations sent a letter to Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr. today, raising significant concerns with the National Institutes of Health's, NIH, proposal to create a national autism registry. The registry was detailed during an April 21 presentation by NIH Director Jay Bhattacharya, which he described as a real-world data platform for developing national disease registries, including a new one for autism. The Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, has since claimed it is not creating an autism registry, but the department has failed to engage with autistic people and advocates, exacerbating the lack of clarity. Instead of engaging with the communities this proposal would impact most, federal health agencies have taken every opportunity to shut disabled and autistic people out of the conversation, leaving unanswered questions, a sense of alarm, and deepening mistrust, said Vania Lavelle, ACLU Senior Legislative Counsel. Trust in federal health data requires affirmative, good faith engagement with autistic people, appropriate safeguards for privacy, and ensuring any proposal helps, not hurts, the communities impacted. The letter outlines the many unanswered questions left by NIH's data platform proposal, including what data it will collect, what sources it will rely on, how it will anonymize and secure the data. It also highlights the increased risk of surveillance, stigmatization, and marginalization from data collection, particularly for disabled people, who have a long and troubled history with government efforts to find and track disability for the purpose of eliminating it. It's no secret that this proposal has created a lot of fear and confusion in the autistic community, said Colin Killick, executive director of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. We continue to advocate and support research into autism that autistic people want conducted, but it is critical that autistic people's private data not be shared without our consent. We hope the administration answers our questions to shine light on how autistic people and our rights will be protected. The letter also establishes three key steps NIH and HHS must take to establish trust in its proposed data platform: meaningful communication with autistic people and advocates, fundamental privacy safeguards to prevent misuse and abuse, and ensuring the data platform advances the well-being of autistic people, people with disabilities, and the public health while minimizing potential harms. Next up is an article from the North Island Gazette. The title, Blindfold Sights, Vancouver Island Artist Explores Blindness Through Painting. Rose Kama Morrison's paintings currently showing at an exhibition in Chicago by Elena Rardin, published May 4, 2025. A Port Alberni artist will have her work exhibited at an upcoming show in the United States. Painter Rose Kama Morrison is an artist with vision loss. Four of her recent paintings have been selected for the Passionate Focused Art exhibit in Chicago, Illinois, which starts May 1, 2025 at the Fairmont Hotel. An art auction will take place on the same day. This can be found online at one.bidpal.net/pf2025. This exhibit takes place each year as artists with vision loss submit their work and a jury of professionals selects the work to be included in the exhibit. "It's quite prestigious," said Kama Morrison. "I've been taking part in it since 2011. It is a juried art show, and I've won a couple of awards now, which is exciting." One of her pieces, Storyteller and the Girl with the Red Ball, won the Judy Jessic Juror's Choice Award, second place, in this year's show. The piece is part of Kama Morrison's Blindfold series, where she blindfolds herself before she begins painting. "The Blindfold series started about 3 years ago," she explained, "because I'm losing my vision. I wanted to see what it's like to paint with no vision at all. In my mind's eye, I see what direction I can move the paint in. I'm still starting to learn spatial awareness on the page, and now I'm developing shape." After placing alcohol ink on the page, Kama Morrison removes the blindfold and sees what she can create. "The work is usually very abstract," she says. Kama Morrison was diagnosed with Usher syndrome when she was 16 years old. Usher syndrome is made up of two parts, hearing loss and vision loss. "I was born with moderate to severe hearing loss," explained Kama Morrison. "I wore hearing aids all my life. Then as a teen, I started to notice that I couldn't see in the dark anymore. It wasn't until I was in my 40s that I really started to notice the loss of my vision." Kama Morrison's vision loss is caused by retinitis pigmentosa, which makes cells in the retina break down over time. It's a progressive disease, which means it causes a slow loss of peripheral vision. Kama Morrison describes it as like looking through a straw. Now, in the late stage of retinitis pigmentosa, Kama Morrison has severe periphery loss and is considered legally blind. "I never really let it define me or limit me," said Kama Morrison. "If I want to try something, I do it. I always find adaptations. I want to be able to educate people that people with vision loss can do whatever they want to do." Kama Morrison says adaptations in technology have allowed her to continue her artwork despite her vision loss. She uses her smartphone for reference photos and has specialized lighting tools to keep her art room well lit. "Being organized is really important," she said. "If I drop something, that's a nightmare to try and find it again." Kama Morrison usually paints in alcohol ink, which is a really challenging medium, she says. "I put the ink on a specialized piece of paper, then blow with a straw to manipulate the ink," she explained. "When I see something coming out of it, I start creating shapes with isopropyl alcohol and Q-tips. Household stuff, nothing fancy. It is a very difficult medium to control and requires a lot of patience." Kama Morrison started out painting in a realism style with acrylic paint and watercolors. But as her eyesight diminished, she found her artwork becoming more abstract. "I had to let go of how I used to paint," she said. "It has definitely opened a whole new world for me when it comes to creating." Born and raised in Port Alberni, Kama Morrison says she finds that the Alberni Valley is a blank canvas for all sorts of creative inspiration. Outside of this upcoming exhibit, Kama Morrison can often be spotted at craft fairs in the Alberni Valley. She can also be found on social media, Rose Kama Morrison on Facebook and at Rose T K M O, that's at R-O-S-E-T-K-M-O, on Instagram, where she often has art demos. Kama Morrison is also partnered with the art agency Art Lifting. And now, an article from The Independent. Uproar as disability rights protesters in wheelchairs dragged out of House Medicaid meeting. You're going to kill me. Republicans insist the proposed new work requirements won't hurt people with disabilities, but disability rights advocates disagree. By Eric Garcia. Washington, D.C., Tuesday, 13 May, 2025. Disability rights protesters in wheelchairs clashed with Republican lawmakers Tuesday as they sought to discuss and debate their sprawling legislation on Medicaid, which led to police dragging advocates out. The House Committee on Energy and Commerce, which governs Medicaid, began its markup for its part of the legislation that Republicans have taken to calling One Big Beautiful Bill. At one point, one advocate shouted at Republican lawmakers, saying, "You will kill me." As Capitol Police escorted the protester out, she shouted, "Bull, liar." Throughout the hearing, disability rights advocates interrupted discussions to protest the cuts. Under the House budget resolution that passed earlier this year, the House has to find $1.5 trillion in spending reductions to unlock $4.5 trillion worth of tax cuts. If Republicans fail to cut $2 trillion worth of spending, the amount of money left for tax cuts will be reduced by the difference between $2 trillion and the final number of savings. Republicans claimed throughout the hearing that the legislation would not hurt people with disabilities. Under the bill, able-bodied adults without dependents must engage in at least 80 hours of either work, community service, or education to be eligible for Medicaid. Republican Representative Gary Palmer of Alabama pushed back against accusations that people with disabilities would lose their Medicaid coverage. "The people who are legally eligible for Medicaid are not going to lose their Medicaid," he insisted. "We've all got family members, friends, we've got people in our districts, and we know these stories, people that are depending on Medicaid, and you will not lose your Medicaid." But the protester interrupted Palmer, identifying herself as from Youngstown, Ohio, and said that her drugs cost $10,000 a month. Republican Representative Dan Crenshaw of Texas tried to tamp down criticism as people with disabilities expressed fear that they might lose their coverage. "Here's my apology to you. I'm sorry that people lie to you. I'm sorry that so many people in the media and the left have lied to you," he said. Many Republicans have said that the legislation would only cut coverage for able-bodied men and specifically focused on undocumented immigrants. But disability advocates say that the legislation's requirements to have states determine if patients are eligible for Medicaid every 6 months could cause some to lose benefits. "There are lots of people with disabilities who may not meet the specific Social Security definition, but who absolutely do have disabilities," Katie Neese, the CEO of the ARC, told The Independent. Neese also said that the cuts to Medicaid could wind up causing states to cut optional programs, such as Medicaid home and community-based services, which allows for people to stay in their homes rather than in nursing homes. "Because it's an optional program, it has long waiting lists to apply, varying by states. The choice is to go in an institution or, more likely, people will just be put out and their families will do the best they can for them, but isn't going to be sufficient for what they need, she said. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, who joined the committee this Congress, praised the advocates for their protests. First and foremost, I think that they have demonstrated a tremendous amount of courage and bravery, putting themselves on the line in order to defend Medicaid for people across the country and the Affordable Care Act, she told The Independent. She feared that the able-bodied requirement might exclude some people who desperately need Medicaid. Does it include people with varying degrees of mental health diagnosis? She asked. Ocasio-Cortez also pointed out that the legislation would also roll back a rule from the Biden administration, requiring that a minimum number of staff work at nursing homes. This is definitely going to affect people who rely on nursing homes, the staffing that happens in nursing homes. This is all in the text of the bill, and on top of that, including people who are eligible and covered by Medicaid, she said. During the hearing, Ocasio-Cortez pointed out how many people in areas, including those represented by Republicans, depend on Medicaid. Representative Greg Landsman, a moderate Democrat from Ohio, questioned why people needed to be dragged out from the hearing. It seems strange that folks in wheelchairs would be arrested, he said. Quite frankly, it's a life or death situation for them. I understand that they can't disrupt a proceeding, so they need to be removed. But why arrested? Numerous House committees are engaged in marathon markups of their parts of the bill. Republicans, led by President Donald Trump, hope to pass the bill that ramps up spending for immigration enforcement at the Mexican border and boosts oil exploration, while also extending the 2017 tax cuts that Trump signed in 2017. But the bill will face stiff opposition in the Senate, where many Republicans, including allies of the president, worry about steep cuts to Medicaid. And now, from the ABA, that's the American Bar Association, to disclose or not, understanding disability identity in law school admission, May 12, 2025. In 2022, the Law School Admissions Council, LSAC, surveyed first-year law students to understand how disability identity shapes the law school experience. Recently, LSAC released an updated report, First Year Law School Class, A Focus on Students with Disabilities, 2023 update, based on responses of 1Ls with disabilities for the 2023-2024 academic year. Staff Director Amy Albright and Chair Robert Bob Dinnerstein co-authored a blog post responding to the data regarding respondents' decisions whether to disclose their disabilities. To disclose or not, understanding disability identity in law school admissions, April 28, 2025, by Amy Albright and Robert Bob Dinnerstein. The experiences of law students with disabilities and their choices around self-disclosure remain under-examined. Understanding their experiences is essential to creating an inclusive and equitable legal education system, ensuring that law schools are serving all students and helping to create, over time, a legal profession that better reflects and can better serve our population, including individuals with disabilities. To better understand how disability identity shapes the law school experience, in 2022, LSAC took an important step to aggregate the experiences of individuals with disabilities in the law school application and decision-making processes. LSAC surveyed first-year law students, 1Ls, and issued a report. An updated report, First Year Law School Class, A Focus on Students with Disabilities 2023 Update, has been published based on the responses of 1Ls with disabilities for the 2023-2024 academic year. We found most thought-provoking the data regarding respondents' decisions whether or not to disclose their disabilities. We acknowledge that ultimately the decision to disclose is highly personal and depends on a variety of factors. Particularly noteworthy was that while the percentage of 2023 1L respondents who identified as a person with a disability was the same as 2022 1L respondents, 12%, 24% of 1Ls in 2023 did not answer the question about disability at all, compared to 6% of 1Ls in 2022, a striking 120% increase. Why such a significant change in a one-year period? Have students concerns about potential disability biases or discrimination in admissions decisions increased? Do more students believe that reducing one's identity to just one aspect, disability, ignores that they are multifaceted, embodying a multitude of characteristics, experiences, and attributes beyond any single label and may overshadow their other qualities and experiences? Or is it something else driving this change? Of course, we cannot determine whether the significant rise in non-responses resulted from an increase in students with disabilities opting not to answer, or from students without disabilities not responding due to objections to the question, a belief that the identity was not important to negate, or other factors. As to who disclosed their disabilities, the 2023 and 2022 data were similar. Almost half of all 1Ls with disabilities, 49%, disclosed on all their law school applications. However, racially and ethnically marginalized 1Ls were more likely not to disclose their disabilities, 43%, than white, 37%, 1Ls. Why is this? Many students from marginalized racial and ethnic groups may have had negative educational experiences in the past, whether due to discrimination, cultural insensitivity, or lack of support. Therefore, they may believe that their disclosure would negatively affect their admissions chances or that they would not receive the support they need. These students may also fear that disclosing a disability will affect their eligibility for scholarships or other funding opportunities. Disclosing a disability could also compound biases and stereotypes that they already face due to their other identities. In addition, some racial and ethnic communities may perceive disabilities as a failure, weakness, and a source of shame. There also may be a lack of visible role models or mentors who share the students' racial or ethnic backgrounds and disclose their disabilities. Particularly noteworthy, LSAC this year collected data on disclosure by program type, full or part-time, and law school selectivity quatrel. 64% of part-time 1Ls with disabilities disclosed their disabilities to all the schools they applied to, compared to 46% of full-time students, almost 30% or 18 percentage points more. Why the significant difference? Many part-time students are balancing work, school, and family and may be more willing to disclose to receive the accommodations they need. These students may be more comfortable and confident disclosing their disabilities in an academic setting because they have disclosed and requested accommodations at their workplace. Because part-time students are often older and have more life experience, they may be more comfortable advocating for themselves if it helps them succeed academically. Additionally, the data showed that the more selective the school, the less likely students with disabilities were to disclose, compared to students who enroll at schools in Q2, Q3, and Q4 combined. 31% more students enrolled in the top 25% highly selective law schools, Q1, chose not to disclose to any schools they applied to. Among 1Ls with disabilities who chose not to disclose to any schools they applied to, most often because they thought it would disadvantage their application, 36% subsequently enrolled in the Q1 schools, compared to those who did not disclose their disabilities on any of their applications, who enrolled in schools in Q2, 18%, Q3, 28%, and Q4, 18%. Numerous reasons may account for these findings. Students with disabilities applying to highly competitive, high-prestige law schools may be feeling intense pressure to meet high academic expectations without any assistance. These students may have a number of additional concerns. That schools might consider them to be less qualified than their non-disabled peers, especially if they received accommodations in the past. Their disclosing their disabilities could overshadow or undermine their identity as high achievers. That their peers may perceive accommodations as special treatment or an unfair advantage. That disclosure could negatively affect their chances of securing competitive internships, fellowships, or postgraduate positions. That elite schools may be less likely to provide accommodations that require significant adjustments to teaching or testing methods. Additionally, students with disabilities may see a lack of representation by disabled students, faculty, and leaders, reinforcing the notion that the schools are not welcoming to and inclusive of them. We are encouraged by LSAC's initiative to survey students with disabilities, as we have not had good statistics on the number of students who identify as disabled. While there is more to be done, this is a commendable first step. I'll pause here now to remind you that you are listening to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. And now a piece entitled, Cowichan Man Shares the Challenges of Being Blind on Vancouver Island. This comes from Parksville, Qualicum Beach News. Mitch Kidd speaks on the challenges and frustrations of being legally blind in the community, by Chad Cawson, published May 17, 2025. In today's world, too many are blind to blindness and count out visually impaired people like Mitch Kidd, who was born premature and has retinopathy of prematurity, ROP. "I love to raise awareness," said Kidd. "I have basically always been blind, but I'm a very strength-based person, and I don't identify with the word disability. It's not that I don't think others can or should, but for me, being blind is one of my characteristics. It's not blindness that is actually the issue, but rather people's attitudes towards it. By itself, with the right training and techniques, blindness is sometimes just a bit of a nuisance. That's it. It's when people have ideas about blindness or prejudice about it. That's where the issues come." Kidd, who was originally from Cape Town, South Africa, first learned Braille while attending a school for the blind and describes the experience as a mixed bag. "I appreciated learning the skills, but the staff there were not always the nicest to the children, so it wasn't the best," said Kidd. "On the other hand, I did learn a lot of valuable skills there, so that is what you have to focus on." Kidd first moved to Canada in 1994, completing high school in Chilliwack before attending university in Vancouver, earning a degree in psychology. Kidd, who took a unified English Braille code course through a woman in Kelowna, admits finding work in Chilliwack proved to be difficult, and called the Cowichan Valley home in 2017 after accepting a position as a Braille educational assistant with School District 79. "I loved the students and really enjoyed working at the high school," said Kidd. "I had two students who were assigned to me, but you always do more. My favorite part of my time there was being able to connect with the youth and being that blind mentor for them, because a lot of what they have in the schools are sighted people who are doing all these things, and they often haven't met a blind adult who can be real with them and say, 'Look, this is how it is,' or 'You can do this.' It's a lot different when a blind person says it compared to when a sighted person says, "This is hard, but we're going to get through it." Kid gets through life by using non-visual techniques, such as reading Braille over print and using a screen reader to access a computer. Kid left SD79 in 2021 to accept a position with Cowichan Valley Youth Services. Kid worked with CVYS for nearly 2 years. Kid held back on getting a guide dog for a while as he wanted to hone his cane skills first, but has now been paired up with Mario since August 2023. "Having Mario has truly been a cool experience," said Kid. "It has been fun to build and have that relationship with him. I love keeping up his training and making sure that he's doing what he is supposed to be doing. The other day we had to find a pole that indicated a bus stop, and he just learned it so quickly, and now he shows me that bus stop every time we pass it. He's just such a good boy, so maybe everything worked out for the best." Kid often feels frustrated by the people out there who are buying vests and harnesses online and pawning off their pets as genuine service animals when that's not the case. Dogs that are not properly trained might exhibit poor behavior when in a store, which can then have negative impacts for those like Kid, who actually depend on genuine service animals. While on the lookout for new opportunities, Kid currently works part-time for the Pacific Training Center for the Blind in Victoria and has been there since last May. "It was a dear friend of mine who started it, and she has done just so many awesome things for the blind community," said Kid. "She had put up a post on Facebook that they were looking for an instructor, so I had phoned her up to let her know that I had applied, and the rest is history. I love it. Every day that I'm there, I just love it." Kid is looking forward to completing the 10-month provincial instructed diploma program through Vancouver Community College that teaches skills on how to effectively teach adults. Aside from Braille, Kid, who is passionate about technology, computers, AI, and cooking, would love to teach in any of those areas. "I started it last fall, and I'm just sort of taking my time in case something wasn't accessible," said Kid. "The program is not funded with any conventional funding, such as student loans, so I've been applying for scholarships. I've often wondered if there is anyone within the community that would be interested in sponsoring someone to do something like this, and then in return, I could teach for them or helping them in some way, almost like a bit of a partnership. That would be so neat." Kid said one of the biggest frustrations while looking for work opportunities is being passed over by employers without them doing their research or asking questions. "I'll apply for a job and be asked, 'What is it I can do?' But I would not apply for the job if I didn't feel I could do it," said Kid. "I find that employers feel it is going to be an imposition or expensive to hire someone who is blind, or that they are going to have to do all these extra things, and it just isn't true. There's a lot of talk about hiring blind people, but when it comes down to it, I don't find there's a lot of action." Kid is a person of action who is very capable and wants to be treated as such, not praised for doing simple things such as waking up in the morning, which comes off as less of a compliment and more degrading. People will praise you for doing something that everyone else is doing, but because you are blind, they're going to praise you extra for that," said Kid. "My biggest message is to interact with me like you would anybody else. I'm just a person who happens to be blind. I often find when walking the streets of Duncan that people won't acknowledge me, and I find it very unfriendly. If you see me on the street, don't just step or pull your children out of the way. Say hello or let me know what side you're passing on, because I truly love to talk and interact with people." Now an article from the Washington Post, entitled, "Families of Disabled Children Frequently Struggle to Pay Medical Bills." Researchers reported that 22% of families with children who have disabilities faced hardship and that insurance coverage is inadequate. This was posted May 19, 2025 by Hannah Dr. Loeb. Families of children with disabilities were nearly twice as likely to report financial hardships as families of those without disabilities, according to a recent study published in the Journal of American Medical Association Network Open. Analyzing data for 22,670 children ages 5 to 17 from the 2019-2022 National Health Interview Survey, researchers recently found that some 22.3% of families with children who have disabilities experienced financial hardship. In comparison, about 12.6% of families with children who don't have disabilities faced such difficulties. The researchers cited an overall prevalence of disability of 17.4% based on self-reporting by parents. The most commonly reported disabilities were emotional or behavioral, with 10.8% of parents reporting one or more. According to the study, families of children with disabilities had more difficulty paying their medical bills than other families and were more likely to have either public insurance or a combination of public and private insurance. They were also more likely to worry about expenses and had higher rates of delayed or foregone care due to cost. The findings suggest that current insurance is inadequate for disabled children and that the situation could get worse, the study says. Proposed cuts to the federal contribution to Medicaid would likely exacerbate the financial distress of these families, the authors write. These data demonstrate a need to structure health insurance policies to ensure that children with disabilities have their needed medical care covered in a way that is not financially burdensome to families. Next up is a piece from Cronkite News. It's entitled, Phoenix Disability Creator Dani Medina Shares Her Experience Living with a Rare Chronic Illness, by Shayla Daverman, published May 14, 2025. Phoenix. Dani Medina thought she was dying. A rare genetic disorder and a severe case of COVID-19 left her rapidly declining. Her response was to pack her bags. I'm just going to travel and then die. She started to post more on her social media about her illness, creating a bucket list of places she wanted to go, seeking answers from a bigger community and documenting the journey along the way. Medina, 26, is Pascua Yaqui and was born and raised in the Maryvale area of Phoenix. She's witty and flashes her bright, inviting smile as she laughs between her sentences. Her left nostril is pierced and her dark, curly hair waves down to the middle of her back. At 8, she started playing basketball, but any minor collision would cause major immediate bruising or bleeding, so she was often benched. No one thought to ask why. I was born with this and nobody really caught it because it's rare, Medina said. The thing no one caught is a connective tissue disorder called vascular Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, or VEDS. An estimated 6,000 to 8,000 people in the U.S. have VEDS, with a life expectancy average of about 48 years. VEDS is a genetic disorder that can be inherited from a parent or result from a new mutation. The disorder affects both men and women. While symptoms are not always present in childhood, they eventually worsen and cause life-threatening complications. Maryvale isn't the greatest area, and my primary doctor was based in Maryvale, she said. I didn't have the resources, nor did I have the doctors who were very knowledgeable about what could be going on with me. On the road she went, determined to celebrate her favorite holiday, Christmas, by attending a light display in Denver despite her physical condition. That's when her first video blew up on TikTok, gaining millions of views and attention from celebrities overnight. I woke up the next day, and then I had amassed like 500,000 followers, Medina said. I was like, whoa. But I've transitioned more to Instagram now. It has a large disability community on there, and it's a lot more disabled-friendly, I would say, with the captions and accessibility to videos and whatnot. This community helped her understand VEDS better by sharing their advice, treatments, experiences, and diagnoses. Now Medina is close friends with the then stranger who helped guide her to answers. Medina says with VEDS she has to be cautious. Her wife, Taylor Medina, and family help her adapt. That could mean driving to the top of the mountain instead of hiking it, no longer being able to wear jeans because they're restrictive and rough on her joints, taking quiet night trips to the grocery store, avoiding traffic, or implementing adaptive tools to make life easier. Her account on Instagram is a mix of educational content about her health journey, modeling career with Zebedee Talent, an inclusive modeling agency, and her day-to-day life. Medina is also an activist for Indigenous visibility, women's and LGBTQIA+ rights, and the disability community. Sprinkled throughout her page are advice videos about attending events, restaurants, traveling with a disability, and how to be mindful. She wants to normalize life with a chronic illness, focusing on daily experiences. After following other creators with disabilities and seeing that their style of content creation was more about daily existence, she shifted her focus, realizing that they don't have to be inspirational for people to care about them. She also uses closed captions and includes captions for people with both visual and auditory disabilities, so her audience can fully engage. Medina is open about her past drug use. She said as a teen she was addicted to opioids and methamphetamine. In a post from 2021, she discussed the difficult relationship between being a recovered addict and now having to rely heavily on opioids to make her as comfortable as she can be. They wouldn't prescribe harsh opioids if they didn't think I absolutely needed them, Medina wrote in one of her posts. I no longer have shame in needing all of these to live comfortably. Of course, it's conflicting, but I'm still alive, and that's all I can ask for at this point. Medina said she is deeply considerate of the burden that death can pose, so she plans carefully for when the time comes. Money that is accrued on there, Instagram and TikTok, I put it into an account that's for my funeral. About one quarter of non-institutionalized working-age adults with disabilities live below the poverty line in 2023, more than twice the rate of adults without disabilities. I'm very fortunate because a lot of disabled people are in poverty, unfortunately, Medina said. I think had I not gone after modeling, I definitely would not have an income, and then I probably would qualify for disability, Social Security Disability Insurance. Changing social and cultural awareness has led to an increase in on-screen representation of people with disabilities over the past century. However, out of 27 actors who won awards for playing a character with disabilities, only two have been disabled actors, Marley Maitland and Harold Russell. While there is more representation, Medina and many others feel the best way to facilitate accurate, authentic portrayals of the disability community is to prioritize those who are living that experience. This means asking questions beyond their diagnosis. I feel like their experiences more than their diagnosis matter, Medina said. May is Awareness Month for Vascular Ehlers-Danlos Syndrome, dedicated to outreach and education. And now from the Disability Scoop, Apple Unveiling New Accessibility Features by Sean Heasley, May 20, 2025. Technology giant Apple is introducing a host of new features aimed at helping those with various disabilities. The company said this month that it will add accessibility nutrition labels to the product pages of apps and games in its App Store. The labels will give users details about whether an offering is compatible with accessibility options like voice control, larger text, sufficient contrast, reduced motion, captions, and more before they download it. Apple said it will provide specifics for developers so that they will know what criteria their apps must meet in order to indicate that different accessibility features are supported. Consumers deserve to know if a product or service will be accessible to them from the very start, said Eric Bridges, president and CEO of the American Foundation for the Blind. These labels will give people with disabilities a new way to easily make more informed decisions and make purchases with a new level of confidence. In addition to the labels, Apple said that it's enhancing Braille capabilities on iPhone, iPad, Mac, and Apple Vision Pro, and giving users new ways to customize text in order to make reading easier for individuals with dyslexia, low vision, and other disabilities. The company is also adding live captioning capabilities on Apple Watch, among other improvements. At Apple, accessibility is part of our DNA, said Tim Cook, the company's CEO. Making technology for everyone is a priority for all of us, and we're proud of the innovations we're sharing this year. That includes tools to help people access crucial information, explore the world around them, and do what they love. The accessibility updates will be available later this year, Apple said. Here's another piece from the Disability Scoop. This one's entitled, States Drop Effort to Overturn Section 504, but Continue to Challenge Disability Protections, by Michelle Diament, May 19, 2025. 17 states are no longer seeking to invalidate one of the nation's key disability rights laws, but advocates say threats remain. A lawsuit brought by Texas and 16 other states garnered significant attention earlier this year because it sought to declare Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act unconstitutional. The 1973 law bars discrimination on the basis of disability at any entity that receives federal funds. It has a wide reach affecting health care, public education, housing, transportation, and much more. Disability advocates pushed back against the state's move to overturn the statute, warning that a successful challenge to the constitutionality of Section 504 could also undermine other laws, including the Americans with Disabilities Act. After facing backlash, the states are withdrawing their constitutional claim. Plaintiffs further clarify that they have no intention to seek any relief from this court on count three, Section 504 is unconstitutional, of their complaint, including that in their demand for relief. Reads a recent status update the state attorneys general filed with the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Texas. However, the states are still pursuing the broader case, now known as Texas versus Kennedy, which was filed in response to an update to Section 504 regulations that the Biden administration finalized last year. The decision to drop the constitutional claim shows the power of the disability community's advocacy, said Shira Wachschlag, Senior Executive Officer for Legal Advocacy and General Counsel at the ARC. However, the case remains a significant threat to the rights of people with disabilities, as the 17 states continue to challenge the updated Section 504 regulations covering, among other things, the right to receive services in the community, accessible medical equipment, and prohibiting medical discrimination against people with disabilities. The regulations issued by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services marked the first update to Section 504 regulations in 50 years. The rule clarified that medical providers cannot make treatment decisions based on disability biases, expanded the availability of accessible medical diagnostic equipment like exam tables, and set expectations for accessibility on providers' websites and mobile applications, among other changes. The final regulation is responsive to extensive information about the types of discrimination and barriers that people with disabilities face in accessing HHS-funded health and human services. It was based on thousands of comments from people with disabilities, their families, and a wide range of providers, states, and other covered entities. Decades of enforcement activities by the Office of Civil Rights and the Department of Justice under Section 504, and reams of research about disability discrimination in health and human services and the impacts of it, said Allison Barkoff, a professor at George Washington University who led HHS's Administration on Community Living under the Biden administration. It would be a major step backwards in protecting people with disabilities from discrimination in federally funded health and human services if the HHS Section 504 regulations are thrown out. And that is the last article for this edition of the Disability News. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. I thank you for tuning in and invite you to join us again next time.